This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the Upstage Cabaret in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. You know, there's plenty of theories about why famed writer Ernest Hemingway shot and killed himself. Some say he suffered from bipolar disorder or that he had depression. But in the new book, Hemingway's Brain, psychiatrist Andrew Farah offers a new theory. He proposes that Hemingway suffered from a progressive degenerative brain disease that we sometimes see in boxers or football players. And Farah believes that Hemingway himself left clues about his condition in his writing. Andrew Farah is chief of psychiatry at the High Point Division of the University of North Carolina Healthcare System, and he welcomes us. He's here right now on the State of Things. I'd like to welcome him to the show.
Thank you. Great. Thank you.
Good to have you here. You're a practicing psychiatrist. What led you to the story of Ernest Hemingway?
Right. Well, thanks for having me. Yes. I've seen numerous patients like this where they present with a form of dementia, and it's just a puzzle. We have to figure out where that dementia comes from. But about 17 years ago, I met a Hemingway biographer named Bill Smallwood, real nice fellow who had written the Idaho Hemingway, focusing on just the last 10 years of his life. And he asked the simple question, why did Hemingway deteriorate and actually commit suicide after his shock therapy, when he had read that 90% of people who get ECT or get electroconvulsive therapy get the cure they were hoping for? And I said, well, the patients who decline after ECT usually have some undiagnosed organic brain disease, and the ECT is that biological stressor that causes it to be manifest. And we just didn't know it until that stress was on the system. And he said, well, what was that organic disease for Hemingway? And I said, well, let me read your book and read all the others and figure it out. And it became a quasi-addiction, really.
Well, so let's talk about that ECT. Yes. You're talking about electroconvulsive therapy, shock treatments, right? And they work for some people, but that would be based on which diagnosis? Who do they work for?
They generally work for psychosis, depression and psychosis, right? Major depression so severe as to have psychosis, for catatonia, for forms of mania, psychosis, and even certain drug reactions can be broken with ECT. It does have that 90% cure rate for the right diagnosis. He got it for the wrong diagnosis.
So there you are. There's your clue right there. If he had had that, if he was properly diagnosed with depression or bipolar disorder, more than likely it would have made him better. And he actually declines rapidly, suggesting it made him worse. And that's where you think, well, an actual brain trauma might have been undiagnosed.
Absolutely. You know, when you read the Hemingway biographies, so many people just repeat the cliches. They say, well, he was bipolar, or alcoholism explains everything, or he was narcissistic. And the pieces of truth are, yes, he had family. He had a son who was bipolar, for sure. He was a very functional and brilliant alcoholic for a long time before the alcohol really began to take its toll and people noticed in public. But the truth is that he had 9 major concussions during his life. And it was amazing to me that no one had put these pieces together. He put the pieces together. You know, he wrote, I start the book with the story The Battler, which he wrote as a very young man, about a boxer named Ad Francis, who is really a composite of other boxers that Hemingway knew of, who suffered from chronic traumatic encephalopathy. But unfortunately, though Hemingway was ahead of his time and could write about CTE, medical science had not caught up with him. In fact, in 1960, 1960, when he was first getting treated, there was an article by a psychiatrist who called it accident neuroses. He said, these people who claim to have concussions and have all these symptoms afterwards, they're just looking for attention, right? They're not organically ill.
So not only was it not a diagnosis, but you have there are psychiatrists who are dismissing it.
Correct.
And of course, there was some sense of this, right? That, for instance, I think in the boxing world, even up until then, you'd call a fighter punch drunk or punchy. He was clearly, there was something wrong with this guy, and clearly it had to do with his profession, but no diagnosis yet.
Correct. And in fairness, there weren't the scans we have today.
Right.
But if you just look at Hemingway's own biography, you know, we start with World War I, where there was the blast. You know, he's an ambulance driver on the Italian front. 5-gallon bomb explodes, throws him several feet. But that's his first concussive injury, not a direct blow, but a wave of energy. What's important about that is that you can develop chronic traumatic encephalopathy with one blast. Usually we think of multiple blows to the head, but he had that first blast, even having an out-of-body experience with it.
Had an out-of-body experience, which you say is really symptomatic, is one of the good clues to CTE, right?
Absolutely. In fact, we know that 20% of veterans coming back who've suffered blast injuries do report sort of out-of-body experiences. So I know that the paranormal people like to talk about that, not medical people, but it does occur in this type of illness. He wrote about it himself, you know.
Is that the
It's a nice quote. Hemingway says, "There was one of those big noises you sometimes hear at the front. I died then. I felt my soul or something coming right out of my body, like you'd pull a silk handkerchief out of a pocket by one corner. It flew around and then came back and went in again, and I wasn't dead anymore. So, you know, he himself, I think that experience sort of solidified his sort of adolescent invincibility. You know, he wrote to his family that nothing can kill me. He believed nothing. He's proven nothing can kill him.
Well, and he almost does, because that's not the last of his head trauma, right?
Right. Now we forward ahead to 1928. He's in Paris. He's been out drinking with one of his buddies, Archie MacLeish. He comes in, goes to the restroom, and instead of pulling the cord for the commodes, grabs the cord for the skylight and pulls a skylight onto his head and gives himself another concussion, requiring multiple stitches. He carried that scar in his left frontal area the rest of his life. And I think you referenced that wonderful letter from, we were talking earlier about Ezra Pound, you know, how did you get so drunk to fall upwards through the blithering skylight?
You know? That's a great quote. And great it could one. Only come from a poet like Ezra
only
Pound,
Ezra Pound,
right?
Yeah. I think my favorite Pound letter to Hemingway is when he said, you know, he called him a lion, you're a darn lion hunter, and all you're doing is shooting pussycats. I don't care how big they are. They're just pussycats, and they don't have a gun to shoot back, you know.
There you go.
But we zoom ahead to the Blitz in London. It's blacked out, and he's in a passenger seat of a car. The driver he got to drive because he was, quote, no drunker than Hemingway, right? So that's how they decided who drove. But they plow into a water tower, and his head hits the windshield, requires 57 stitches, another concussion. His Cuban doctor believed his symptoms indicated a subdural hematoma as well. Who knows? We didn't have scans. But then we zoom ahead further in World War II, and he's in the sidecar of a motorbike with Robert Capa on an ill-advised mission in no man's land. A German anti-tank round blows him off of the motorcycle and hits his head on a boulder. So in that instance, he has the wave injury of energy and a direct blow. Another fall on his fishing boat, another car accident in Cuba, and by the time he has the two plane crashes in Africa, right?
So the invincibility part,
right.
Kind of true.
Absolutely.
In fact, he proved it. He had to kill himself to do it. But again, these blows, one after another. He's also an amateur boxer.
Correct. He boxed through his adolescence and adult life. He played football in high school, and even in Sun Also Rises, he writes about being kicked in the head early in a football game and what it's like to feel your senses change and so forth. He used the word concussion in his own letters and listed numerous post-concussive symptoms. I had his, not even the collected letters, just selected letters rather than I would put a sticky tab on the margin every time he talked about post-concussive symptoms or the word concussion. It's like seven tabs sticking out, you know.
Well, tell us more about your research, because it is exhaustive. We're going to talk in a minute about the dangers of posthumous diagnoses, and I know that you address that, but let's talk about what you looked at and the kind of research you did to write this book.
Right. Well, I started with all the biographies, then you turn to the memoirs of people who knew him. Then you can look at so many of his letters, and those that are not in published form, you can find them at different auction sites and websites and so forth. And of course, the John F. Kennedy Library and Museum has the Hemingway papers, so making a couple of trips there. And that's such an exciting thing to do, to look at, you know, fragments of stories that he started and stopped, or early drafts of stories, and see how that mind was really working. It was a true genius.
Part of the later diagnoses, and as people sort of understood his behavior and a little bit about how his mind worked, I mean, he was also accused of being paranoid later on in his life. And we can talk some about the symptoms, but the fact is he did have an FBI file.
Yes.
So they are after me, and I might be paranoid. Right. And you looked at that too, the FBI file.
Right. Due to the Freedom of Information Act, you can view his whole file. Now, it has been very fashionable to say lately, aha, he did have an FBI file, therefore he was not paranoid. The truth is, the kind of delusions he had, he thought that there was a man in his bathroom tape recording everything he said. He thought one of the interns at the Mayo Clinic was an FBI agent in disguise. He thought he'd be arrested for indecent liberties with a minor, which wasn't true, or for undeclared gambling winnings. So the kinds of delusions he had were independent of that, and they were more what we see with dementia, these kinds of varieties where there might even be a vascular component, because he did have untreated diabetes and hypertension through his adult life. But the file, as it existed, was really not news to him. I mean, he was in the Spanish Civil War, right? I almost said he fought. He carried arms, but he didn't exactly fight. But any American who was involved in the Spanish Civil War and came back to Cuba is going to have an FBI file. And he spoke with FBI agents in Cuba trying to locate communists who had come over from Spain. So the contents of the file would not be unknown to him, and it would not have surprised him if he read it.
You also took a look at his writing and how it changed over time, again, to help you solidify your belief that that CTE was the right diagnosis. Tell us about the change in his writing and what that told you.
Well, you know, the old excuse was that his own physician would say, would pull out passages of Green Hills of Africa and say, this represents a drunk Hemingway and this represents a sober. I think it's more complicated than that. I think that the genius that it took, you know, we were talking earlier about hills like white elephants. These four beautiful words is poetry, right? But that started as 83 words. You can look at the original draft. Those 83 words were distilled and distilled into these beautiful four words. That takes cognitive ability and processing. And also the archetypal structures with which he worked were very much Joycean. I mean, now the current thinking is that Hemingway and Joyce were doing the same things, the same stories in their archetype, but only Hemingway's surface is very superficially simple, whereas Joyce's is superficially complex. And we accept a detailed, studied reading of Joyce, and we kind of dismiss that with Hemingway, which is our mistake, and we miss a lot by doing that. But I think the brain power needed to distill those kinds of things and to convey those archetypes was simply gone. And I think he always said when he couldn't write, he didn't want to live. And I think that the ECT, the shock therapy, simply propelled that dementia, that CTE. It was a biological and psychological stress his brain could not handle. But I think if you look at the works, that the posthumous works, Garden of Eden, Islands in the Stream, and Movable Feast, and of course True at First Light, these are things that he never wanted. Well, he didn't want Movable Feast published. Mm-hmm. It wasn't up to his standards, and he knew that his abilities had declined.
So they would, but also, as you say, he was a chronic alcoholic. That's going to take its toll, right. and he's getting older, some form of dementia. To what extent can you attribute his decline in writing to CTE, and you know, what were the other influences, and how do they play a part?
Yes. I mean, I think that one of my friends, Linda Miller, says that no one could imitate Hemingway better than Hemingway, right? And I think later in life, he does, it's sort of like they're almost forgeries. You know, he has enough technique, but the skill is just not there. And we forget, Movable Feast was edited for 2 solid years by his wife and an editor at Scribner's before we ever saw it. So the original manuscript is going to be different. Now, it affected the life. Sadly, when we think about Hemingway's persona and we think about the aggressiveness and the bluster and the volatility and mood swings, sadly, you know, the psychodynamic explanation has been that he was like a spy trapped out too long and he began behaving that way because people expected of him. The truth is the CTE, the chronic traumatic encephalopathy, solidified the very worst aspects of the persona because it makes people have mood swings, volatility, irritability, cognitive difficulties, poor tolerance of alcohol. So I think he was very much organically trapped in that persona.
You talk about the mistake we make in reading Hemingway's work and working backwards. In other words, he's now got this type in his head and he's going to create for us the image that he sees. And you think that we should probably see his work as looking forward. He used his writing as a kind of therapy to work things out.
Absolutely. And it's almost spooky when you look at his fiction and how it predicts his life going forward. You know, I mentioned Ad Francis, the battler who had CTE. Hemingway got CTE. In the story Fathers and Sons, there's fragments of that where he writes about his father's suicide being blamed on a hunting accident, being blamed as an accident. That's exactly what happened when Hemingway shot himself. His wife said, this is an accident. He was cleaning his shotgun, sort of thing. But, you know, D.H. Lawrence said that his pseudo-philosophy did not inform his poetry and his novels. His poetry and novels informed his philosophy. Now, we're so used to looking at Hemingway backwards and saying, aha, this is who in The Sun Also Rises correlates with this friend or this wife and so forth. The truth is, when people said, what is your therapist? He said, my typewriter is my therapist. He meant the act of working was his therapy. I interpret it as the processing, the way he, you know, his writing, this is how he processed his life, and it became his therapy, and that informed his life going forward. So you can think about his biography going forward. Makes perfect sense. The story Fathers and Sons is written after he learns, of course, his father had shot himself with a Colt pistol carried by his father in the Civil War. But he also learned of his very first girlfriend when he's 17 and she's 14, the Indian girl, Prudy Bolton. She killed herself at age 16 when she got pregnant, right? So he learns of her death, his father shot himself, and he writes a story called Fathers and Sons, which is totally happening in a man's mind. His memory is very Joycean, very abstract, very sexual. But that was his therapy of processing it.
Working things out. Well, let's talk about this treacherous terrain that you're walking on, the posthumous diagnosis. So what made you want to take this on? Because it is tricky business, isn't it?
It is. I think the work of the forensic psychiatrist is to look at records. If you can interview the patient, fine, but you look at depositions and medical records and you piece it together. I think you're absolutely right. You know, people will say, was Van Gogh schizoaffective or bipolar, or did he have temporal epilepsy, or was he digoxin toxic because his doctor gave him foxglove? And that's, you know, and I think after you get so much time and so many cultures away, our 21st century nomenclature and psychiatric understandings just fall away. Mm-hmm. You know, like somebody wrote to me once, didn't I think St. Paul was bipolar? I'm like, I have no idea. You know, so I think there's a distance that makes these things virtually impossible. At the same time, we're dealing with a man who had, you know, was the last century, and he has a medical record, and he left a wonderful catalog through his own writing and so many biographies. So I think we can pull it off in his case. I think we can make the right diagnosis. But I think you're absolutely right. We have to be very, very careful because we don't have the patient in front of us. But I think the evidence, I think the book is airtight in that the evidence is just, you can't argue with the numerous concussions. You can't argue with the post-concussive symptoms. Mm-hmm. And we know that, you know, what, something 2% of the population lives with some disability from a head injury. Well, he had 9 of them, you know, for goodness right. sakes.
Right? Well, this also tangentially, I think, leads us to another subject that, you know, sort of about the artist as having some kind of disorder. That's something about what we would consider a mental disorder is actually the virtue and the mm-hmm. and the power behind their work. Talk a little bit about that, because, again, I think that's a treacherous idea as well.
It is. There is this idea, you know, that comes from our, the Rimbaud, right, the derangement of the senses is the ideal position from which to create. Well, goodness, that certainly leads to a lot of drug abuse and so forth. But the bottom line is, yes, poets are more likely to be depressed. Novelists are more likely to have bipolar. Fine, there are these slight increases. But the mental illnesses themselves, once, like we know from Robert Lowell, you know, this poet who was severe bipolar. Now, when he was manic, he thought he was the reincarnation of the Holy Ghost and was standing in traffic in New York trying to stop it. You know, so that is not conducive to creativity. Now, it certainly gave him information and gave him material, beautiful material to work with. But the illness itself is not conducive to the creative process. You know, at the same time, it's a heck of a price to pay yeah. for those experience, you know, to have that. And I think the work that Hemingway did took so much cognitive processing, that was just what was falling away for him. I talk about Willem de Kooning, a contemporaneous artist, probably our greatest abstract expressionist, one of the greatest artists ever, who had a vascular dementia. And he couldn't recognize family members or friends, but he could still paint because the impulse of the abstract expressionist is subconscious. He's mm-hmm. whatever that motivation is, whatever he's conveying, is not a conscious thing. And his tool was the basal ganglia, right? That part of the brain that controls movement. He could paint like riding a bicycle, right? It's mm-hmm. learned memory. Whereas Hemingway needed the higher cortical structures that were dementing.
And when that was actually damaged beyond repair, it showed up in his writing.
Absolutely.
It wasn't contributing yeah. anymore. So what's next for you?
A similar work on Ezra Pound, another contemporary. Well, he was one of those lost generation folks. I always say that Hemingway did not have a monopoly on mental illness and lost generation, right? Joyce had a daughter with schizophrenic. T.S. Eliot married a schizophrenic. Zelda Fitzgerald died here in North Carolina, you know, being treated for schizoaffective mm. disorder. But Ezra Pound is another misunderstood individual who spent his life in a pretty much a hypomanic or manic episode, and that makes his biography suddenly make sense. You know, the treasonous episodes, the anti-Semitism, the strange productivity, it all makes sense in that prism.
Well, we'll have yeah. you back for that, but thanks for talking with us about Hemingway. Mm. Andrew Farah, who is the chief of psychiatry at High Point Division of the University of North Carolina Healthcare System.
Oh, very
his book is called Hemingway's Brain, and you can find out about it at our website, stateofthings.org.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very kind. Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, we're going to hear the music and the stories of the Gate City Divas on the State of Things, and we'll give you a preview right now.
Well, here you are at the door again with tears in your eyes. What's she gone and done this time? Yeah, I'm the one that you turn to when you're needing a friend. I'm the shoulder where you lean to cry. The way she's treating you, can't you see? That ain't how it's supposed to be. So when you've had enough of her, baby, slide on over to me. In the wings by your side, I know that you'll come around. You're gonna see that it's me who's always lifting her higher, and she's the one who brings you down. But you're a one-woman man whose loyalty doesn't give up on things easily. But when you've had enough of her, baby, slide on over to me. Cause I know how to keep you satisfied. With me, it'd be one delicious ride. So when you've had enough of her, baby, slide on over to me. Cause I know how to keep you satisfied. With me, it'd be one delicious ride. So when you've had enough of her, baby, slide on over to me. So when you've had enough of her, baby, slide on over to me. So when you've had enough of her, baby, slide on over to me.